Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're joined by two guests, Dr. Bria Willingham and Dr. Aaron Corbett, who are here to talk to us about their work in higher education in prison and to introduce us to the new Journal of Higher Education in Prison. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Christina.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
I am so glad that you're here and we get to talk about your work. I shared for a moment off air that I'm really passionate about this work, and I'm so thankful that you accepted the invitation to come on. Before we jump into that, would you please tell us a bit about yourself? Aaron, could we begin with you?
Sure. This always seems to be the way Bria and I introduce ourselves because we go alphabetically. So I am Dr. Aaron Corbett. I run the Second Chance Educational Alliance here in Connecticut, which is a program that offers credits toward a bachelor's in business administration in partnership with Southern New Hampshire University. I also run the Quinnipiac University Prison Project down in Hamden, Connecticut, which works with the folks who are incarcerated at York Correctional Institution, which is the state's only facility to house women and those who identify as women or femme and left feminine of center. I also do some evaluation work for a funder to look at state level higher ed in prison programs and optimizing delivery and increasing access. I also do federal and state level advocacy around access and success for justice impacted students. And I have two dogs.
Thank you for sharing that. Bria, would you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, I do not have any pets, but I do live vicariously through Aaron's pet ownership. I am the managing editor of the Journal of Higher Education in Prison, and I've been doing that for, I think, 2 years now. I'm losing track of time. I am also an outgoing associate professor of criminal justice at SUNY Plattsburgh, moving to an associate professor of criminology position at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. So I am very excited about that move. Not so much about the logistics of the moving, though, but my research focuses in part on higher education in prison, particularly women's experiences with education while incarcerated and after their incarceration. So I also do research on the impact of incarceration on Black families and the relationship, particularly between Black fathers and their children. And my work is centered, well, it is, I came into this work, I'll say, because of my family's experiences with incarceration, particularly my brother, who has been in prison for 30 years, wrongfully convicted of a murder, and my nephew, who's also serving life sentences in the state of Pennsylvania. And, you know, my father, formerly incarcerated before he passed away, my sister, brother-in-law. So incarceration, unfortunately, runs deep in my family. And so the work that I do then is always centered on the experiences of the people and the families who are impacted by the criminal legal system.
That was going to be my next question, which is what brought you both to this work? What inspired you into this work? Aaron, would you like to share about that?
Sure. So much like Bria, my entree into this space was and is and remains personal. I have an uncle who is incarcerated in Florida. My nephew is currently incarcerated here in Connecticut. I had a cousin who went in at 16, did 12 years, came out, and due to the constraints of reentry and kind of getting back into the swing of being in community, those pressures were a little bit too difficult for him, and he ultimately ended up taking his life. And so the work that I do really stems from that point and stems from understanding the need to kind of touch as many people as possible so that they know there are people out there who are willing to help them, that there are these educational opportunities, et cetera.
And that leads to my next question, really, which is what led to the founding of this journal and this program? Were you hearing from incarcerated students that they wanted a journal? There are a couple of journals in this space, and yours is opening yet another space. Can you talk about how yours is different and where the call to create this came from?
Well, the journal, Erin and I did not create this journal. The journal was created by two other colleagues of ours in the higher education and prison field, Doctors Mary Gould and Erin Castro. And they invited me to be the managing editor. So the vision of JHEP, which is what we call it, is to be a journal that defines the field of higher education in prison and have the space for critical and critical academic pieces about issues in higher education in prison. We wanted a venue for people who are not only doing research in this space, in this field, but also people who are experiencing higher education in prison as students. So, and the ultimate goal, ironically, is for a journal of higher education in prison to not exist, because the ultimate goal, obviously, as abolitionists, is to not have this system exist as it does. So we often joke, the editors and I, we often joke that we are working to outdo ourselves. we are working to not have to have a journal for higher education in prison.
And there's an impressive masthead of advisors and members of your editorial board, scholars from across the United States, representing a number of wonderful institutions. And there's a very firm, clear statement as well in that section that says the editorial board includes scholars and researchers who are currently and formerly incarcerated. There's also a link you can click if you want to become involved. So how did the original call go out and you amass this group of scholars?
Well, the original call, you mean for the editorial board or...
Yeah, you started creating this in 2019, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Erin Castro and Mary Gould.
The other EC.
I know, right? they started it in 2019. I came aboard in 2020. So I was not the one who did the original call or whatever for the journal itself. So they created the journal. I came on in 2020, as I said. But I originally was invited to be an editorial board member. And then I was invited to be the managing editor. So the vision, though, of amassing the editorial board was to have a varied representation of the higher education and prison field. So that includes people who are formerly incarcerated. That includes people who are inside students. That includes people who are researchers and more traditional academics. That also includes people like myself who are, you know, activist academics. So we wanted to have a varied editorial board, because too often what happens is, you know, you have people who are doing research about issues related to prison in particular, or, you know, higher education in prison in particular, or the criminal legal system as a whole, and they are not including the people who are directly impacted. And you are doing a gross disservice to the field and to your work if you are not including the voices of people who are directly impacted. Because we often say this is, you know, they are rather the subject matter experts as well. So again, so that's what we wanted for the journal. That is still our goal for the journal. And, you know, again, we are trying to have the journal define the field, if you will, because what I am learning, and I'm not going to speak for Mary and Aaron on this, but what I am learning and what I am seeing is that there are many people in the higher education and prison field who are very territorial and have an idea of what higher education in prison is, have all of these thoughts about it, but when they put those thoughts on paper, they don't translate well. So again, with the journal too, we are establishing a standard. We are establishing some integrity with the research that is coming out of this field. We are not a catch-all journal where, oh, okay, so I'm in prison and I'm going to write a poem and just send it to this journal to get it published. Oh, okay, so this is a journal about higher education in prison, so I'm just going to write something about prison and throw it to this journal and it'll get published. That's not what we're doing at all. So we are just coming up on our second volume, which will be published in the fall semester. And so we're learning as we're going, and it is, it has been a learning experience. I'll just leave it at that.
And you say those things in the introduction to volume one. It says starting a journal for a field you wish did not exist and working actively to end is a strange feeling. And it also goes on to say the places in which we work, prisons, jails, and detention centers for adults and children, are racist and inhumane and should not exist. You also talk about a lot of the major questions that you all have working in this field, about barriers, about what future should be worked towards, the complexity of working towards the betterment of a field that you ultimately want to dismantle because you want the system in which you have to teach it to be dismantled as well. The journal seems to be a place where a lot of these very, very difficult things are going to be looked at from a number of points of view as you go along.
Yes, it is. It is. And I don't know, Aaron, I feel like I'm doing a lot of talking. So if you want to jump in, feel free to as well. But I, you know, this, when I look at the field, that, you know, there's just so much wrong with it. And as two Black women, Aaron Corbett and I, working in this space, you know, we come up against a lot of what's wrong with this field. And it's, you know, one journal is not going to fix it all. I just want to make that clear. But in addition to the journal, Aaron and I, we created, along with another colleague of ours, Dr. Bahia Muhammad, created the Jami Sisterhood around the time, well, about a year after the journal was created. And we did that in an attempt to, well, not in an attempt because we are doing it. We created this journal. I mean, excuse me, the Jami Sisterhood to counter the narrative that the higher education in prison field is one that is led by white women. This field is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly led by white women. But that's not the accurate picture of what this field is, because there are many Black women who have been doing the work in this field as well. And so that's why we created the Jami Sisterhood, to represent the Black women who are doing the work, but who are often not invited to the table. And so we said, you know, nix your table. We're creating our own table, and we are building our own chairs, and we are creating our own space for Black women who are doing this work. So Erin, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about Jami.
Yeah. So one of our initiatives is Project Freedom. And it is an initiative specifically designed to increase the representation of Black and Brown folks in this field as instructors, as program administrators, and obviously, and most importantly, as students. And so to do so, we are working with HBCUs and HSIs to really get them motivated to get their programs up and running, get them inside the facilities. Because what's been happening for so long is that we've been begging these white institutions, predominantly white institutions, to increase their diversity numbers, right? So we've been focusing on what is pretty surface compositional diversity, and we have not paid attention to the more systemic ways that Black people are completely erased and dismissed from this field, unless they are the students who also often get tokenized. And so, you know, Project Freedom is an opportunity for us. So Bria Bahia and I to work very closely with these institutions that historically are designed to provide the kinds of opportunities that incarcerated students are needing. They are designed with the community feel, with the kind of grassroots level hustle spirit that our students, the students that we work with, respond to, relate to, respect in many ways. And so it's been super successful. We were just, I mean, Bria was just in Atlanta at Morehouse. Another colleague, one of our subject matter experts, Karanda Porter, who is at the Tennessee Higher Ed Initiative, she and I were in Mississippi a few weeks ago working with Mississippi Valley State University. And they are one of the most on-point programs I have seen in this field in my time in it. And that's because they are led by a Black woman who is former law enforcement and therefore is able to have the kinds of conversations she needs to have to get the programs moving. She also has the support of senior leadership, most specifically the president, who is a Black man, and the provost, who is a Black woman, and who is a very accomplished Black woman at that. And so the conversations, again, that need to happen on the campus so that the campus is bought in are being had in ways that that center, that foreground community, family, communal responsibility, et cetera. Mm-hmm. White folks and white orgs just can't do that.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, what's been interesting about about us doing the work, when we created Jami in spring of 20, right when we were all quarantined, we did a series of six different webinars. And so from May through, I believe, either November or December, we did six different at least six different webinars looking at different issues related to higher education in prison. And so for us, though, it's important to say that when we talk about higher education in prison, we are not just talking about classrooms and syllabi and textbooks and content and curriculum. We are talking about, you know, what higher education in prison really represents outside of the classroom, you know, the social justice issues, the racism that and sexism that and other oppressions that exist within the criminal legal system. So, you know, for us, it's not just about the delivering of the education in the traditional sense, but it's also about, you know, what Black women have to go through just to even get to do the bare minimum of of teaching a course. You know, it is about the baggage that we carry, you know, doing this work. Like Erin and I said in our introductions, we, you know, our families are directly impacted by incarceration. So what does that mean for us as Black women with incarcerated relatives? That means that we enter into these spaces, into these carceral spaces, carrying that emotional baggage, and understanding that when we go into these carceral spaces, that, you know, these spaces are, how do I characterize it, Erin? I say these spaces are created for us because we are Black women. You know, we are not supposed to be Black women who are educated. How dare us? We're not supposed to be Black women with doctorates. How dare us? And so we are coming into a space that was created for our Black bodies, but we are coming in to deliver education, to liberate minds. What? So all of that is, there's so much more nuance to it. There are so many layers that we peel and unpack. And that is something that white women do not do because they don't have to do that, because of the privilege that's attached to their white skin. So for us, you know, this is not a game. This is stuff that we live. This is the issues that we grapple with every single day of our lives as Black women, not only in this space, but Black women in this country.
Yeah, I'm gonna just co-sign basically all of that. not gonna repeat it.
I think I just gave a recap of what I said in our first webinar.
Our like 12-hour webinar. Yeah, I mean, what I do want to emphasize, there are a couple of things I want to emphasize. One, the fact that these buildings were made for us. They were made for our bodies. They were made, right? Because Foucault talks about docile bodies, and that's how corrections, law enforcement, punishment, discipline, that's how they look at the people who are inside of these institutions as docile bodies. And so they are certainly made for us, our physical beings, but these are institutions that will never be able to hold our spirit, will never be able to hold our strength, will never be able to hold our creativity. And that's what we're able to bring into the space. I've been fortunate that I've been able to create relationships with students and have a rapport with students that other instructors can't have, because a lot of the students in my program relate to me as a Black person. And so, you know, it's the difference between being able to kind of joke, play the dozens, whatever you want to call it, and have that be understood and respected and, you know, a good part, a good fun time of the classroom experience, where another instructor, a white instructor, like, you about to be in some trouble. Open your mouth a little too reckless.
Yes.
And so, again, I think it speaks to this broader sense of like how Black people in this like almost philosophical collective unconscious way have this connectivity that we can leverage. And that's, you know, Black women, but also Black men, that we can leverage in the classroom in that space in a way that white instructors cannot.
Right. Exactly.
You both spoke about having very personal knowledge of the work that you do and going into these spaces and then getting to go home. Can you talk about the kind of support it takes for you to be able to do this work?
Oh. Man, listen. It takes a huge mm-hmm. amount of support to do this work. It's been like, I just got off probation. And so there's a way that I just enter correctional spaces as someone who has been a defendant, but who has not been incarcerated, that always just kind of triggers me when I walk into the space. Every time I leave a correctional facility, I can't just drive off. I have to sit and just kind of exhale. I probably call Bria or my friend Kaya in Rhode Island. Like, I call people who have taught inside, who have family members who are incarcerated, who are in this space some kind of way, because you have to let that stuff out. Otherwise, it will build and build and build and build. And then you're no good to anyone because you're burnt out. You haven't done any self-care. But it's difficult because as you're trying to do your own self-care, you are realizing that the people that you are teaching may not have that opportunity to do self-care. And so, like, you're tripping with yourself because you're like, ugh, you know, I need to go get a massage or just drink some coffee, or I just need to do something to relax. But our students don't necessarily have that opportunity. So you feel guilty and you're like, well, maybe I'll just do some work because, you know, I don't deserve to have a good time in my life. But it's your friends and your networks that are like, nope.
Mm-hmm.
You need to take care of yourself. Because if you don't take care of yourself, you can't teach. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't administer this program. You're no good to anyone if you are not being good to yourself.
Right. And for me, it's red wine. You know, that's... I like red wine. That's one of the ways that I unwind. But I do remember many years ago when I was doing a writing workshop at a women's facility in New York State, and it was at least an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes from where I lived at that time. Oh, and I just remember feeling so heavy whenever I would leave the facility and, you know, trying to shake it off, you know, during the drive. And then the moment that I got home, I would have to take a shower because I needed to cleanse, not because the experience with the women wasn't good, because it was, but it was just, you know, I really needed the cleanse for both literally and figuratively to wash away everything bad that the prison represented. And for me, because, you know, I have so many people inside who I'm related to that, I felt myself being extra heavy and bringing home a lot. So that was one of the ways that I did it. And, you know, Jami, another reason why it exists, and Jami is the Swahili word for community. So it's to create that community for Black women who need that release. When we did our first webinar, in May of 20, and I can't believe it's about to be 2 years, 2 year anniversary, that so many of the women said, oh my gosh, I didn't know I needed this. Or, oh my gosh, I knew I needed this, but I didn't know how much I needed it. And so, it helps. So whether it is, you know, jumping on a call with Aaron and just venting, or pouring a glass of wine or two and just exhaling, you know, those are the things that I do. And I think it's important for everyone to find their way to let it go, because it, like Aaron said, if you let it build, then you're going to come to this breaking point and it's not going to be pretty, because I experienced that a couple years ago. But fortunately, therapy has been doing wonders for myself. But is it whatever the outlet is, it's important to do it in this work.
It sounds like a certain amount of self-care is actually aftercare if you don't have community and you don't have institutional support and you don't have the funding. Do you want to talk more about any of those things?
Erin can talk about funding.
Or rather, I can't.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, I mean, the funding scene in this space is, I would argue, the same kind of funding scene that we see in other spaces where the schools and programs that already, Caesar's already just like, I'm anti all of this. Where the schools and the programs that already have like endless amounts of resources simply continue to get more of those resources. And the smaller programs, you know, I run a smaller program. If it's not, you know, directly like attached to a university or, you know, hasn't been in like a high visibility level for an extended period of time, then people just sort of overlook us. A perfect example was with Project Freedom with Jami. We shopped it around to a number of funders who fund in this space and who claim really loudly that they are about equity and racial and ethnic diversity and getting more people of color, more BIPOC people. They love to say BIPOC, getting more BIPOC people in the space. And then they give money to white organizations and institutions and programs to try and find the one or two colored folks that they'll bring on board to participate in their programs. So when we were passing around a proposal that was like, we are going to increase the number of Black and Brown people by going to Black and Brown institutions to find the Black and Brown people, they were like, oh, we don't, this doesn't.
It's align. Too Black and Brown. It's too Black and Brown.
This doesn't really align with our funding priority. We're going to have to get back to you as we change out. We need to figure out, we're deciding what our new funding priorities are, and we'll get back to you. And then we see like the infrastructure of our program being given to other people, and other organizations are then doing the work of racial and ethnic diversity. Work.
But they're really not.
But they're not.
But so, they're really not.
You know, so again, it's just, you know, until we get folks in funding positions that understand the amount of work that a lot of the smaller programs do to keep things moving, we're going to continue to only hear about the same three programs over and over and over again. Like, community colleges have carried the weight of this work since 1972, when the Basic Education Opportunity Grant, which was the Pell Grant before it was first named Pell, they've been carrying this load since then. They've been carrying the load throughout the time that programs were banned if they had the money and capacity to do so. And with Second Chance Pell, they are the majority of institutions that are offering programs to people who are incarcerated, but they consistently are not the ones you hear about. You hear about the big universities that already have the visibility that they need for their programs to run.
Right. You hear about BARD all the time. Everyone thinks BARD is like the only program that exists and the only program that can do higher education in prison. And no true shade to BARD, but, you know, I'm just saying what it is. They are not the only players in the game. And it's always frustrating that whenever we go somewhere and we're speaking, whether we're together or you know, doing separate speaking events, everyone always asks, well, what about BARD? What about BARD? BARD is not it. BARD is not the only player in this, in the higher education in prison field. So, but BARD is the one that consistently gets the money because they're BARD. But fortunately for us, Laughing Gull took a chance and funded us. So we got the initial $50,000 grant. And then what was the second one, Erin? The 3-year one?
Yes. Yeah, so it's $60,000 a year for 3 years.
Yeah. So big shout out to Laughing Gull. Thank you. We always, you know,
big up, yeah. Laughing Gull.
We always have to make sure that we recognize that because you know, they saw our potential, and they know how dedicated we are to this work, and how important we are in this space as Black women. And interestingly enough, when we first announced Project Freedom, we got some pushback from some white women in the field, you know, who were, you know, clutching their fake pearls because they felt as though we were trampling on their backyard. So, you know.
And this conversation about funding takes us back to earlier in the conversation where you talked about the white visibility in this field and the white leadership in this field. If we follow the money trail, we can see that there's a almost closed loop there.
Mm-hmm. You see it too. Yep. Exactly. And so that is one of our biggest frustrations in this space. Right.
You've made your journal open access. It's available online. Mm-hmm. Usually open access is an expensive way to make something available for free. Can you talk about the open access decision? And if you want to talk about funding concerns, I know there are other journals who would like to be open access and can't figure out the brick road forward to lay for themselves to do that.
I can't talk a lot about it because Mary Gold and Aaron Castro laid all of that groundwork prior to me coming on. But so I can't talk about like the funding or how much it costs or whatever. But the rationale behind it is we want everything about this journal to be open. And we want it to be easily accessible, particularly and especially because we are also working with, students who are in prison. So, we know just in the field that access is often a huge issue. So that's the main rationale behind it. And even through our review process, authors can have the option to have their articles reviewed unmasked or masked. So we want complete transparency in the entire process. We want complete transparency in the access to the journal because we have nothing to hide. So that is the rationale behind it. I can't talk about the financial stuff.
I like how you phrased that. I was, when you were saying nothing to hide, and mm-hmm. I was thinking and everything to amplify.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, I like that. Yes.
I have so many questions left, and I know we're running short of time, and I want to make sure you both have an opportunity to use this platform today to talk about the things that you hope most to get across. I did want to ask, what's your favorite part of this job? And it, I don't know that that's the right wording. I know that this is such deeply important work to you. I guess maybe the question is, what keeps you going?
I mean, for me, it's always the students. What I've realized about my life is that every professional endeavor I've had, the ones where I am the least happy is the one where I am furthest away from students. And so to the extent that I am able to remain kind of in somebody's classroom somewhere, you know, that's what keeps me going. I mean, you know, one of my aunts was an educator in Brooklyn for over 25 years, his two master's degrees. Like, education is just a part of who I am. It's part of my DNA. And so when I'm teaching or when I'm learning, that is when I am most engaged and most fulfilled and most wanting to do the most with the least. I'm always doing the most. And just the memory of my, you know, my little cousin, Antonio, you know, I talk to him sometimes and I'm sure he would be proud and all of that. But I just want to make sure that I'm you know, paying respects to his memory and to the life that he lived through this work.
Yeah, I think what keeps me going is my brother. He, like I said in the beginning,
we got Rodney!
30 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. And I cannot even begin to imagine what he experiences on a day-to-day basis, even though we talk about it, but it's still, you know, can't imagine it. And so on those days when I'm like, oh, this is just like, why am I even doing this? I don't, you know, I just don't have the energy for it today. I don't, you know, whatever I'm going through, and I'm just like, forget it. I'm just not even going to do this anymore. And then I look at my brother's picture and I'm like, yes, you are. Right. Cause he, you know, always tells me, you know, keep doing what you're doing. It gives me hope. It gives all of us hope up in here. So, you know, that's why it is my brother. Always, always. And in the stuff, in the classes that I teach, the other research that I do outside of higher education in prison, he's always on the back of my mind. Yes.
There's an article in the first volume of the journal about how human connection is considered contraband. Do you both want to speak to that for a few minutes?
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you think from the perspective, if you look philosophically at Goffman's idea of the total institution, part of what makes the total institution effective, and it's important to note that not only are prisons total institutions, but colleges and universities are also determined to be total institutions,
right?
So in the ways that people think that higher ed institutions and prisons are on these opposite ends of the continuum, I'm like, no, girl, y'all are on the same end.
Right.
so that's sort of one. But in sort of the carceral space, the carceral total institution, the way that conformity and adherence to authority is established is through the disruption of personal bonds. It's about pitting people against each other and making them not trust each other and putting them in situations and spaces where the culture that is perpetuated is one of distrust, lack of transparency, lack of vulnerability, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is part of how prisons do the work that they do. So when volunteers come in who are not part of that cultural structure, our tendency as human beings is to establish that kind of connection. But the prison will often, and I would say always, has these very kind of arbitrary guidelines about what quote unquote undue familiarity is. So there are some agencies that say you can't shake your students' hands. There are some institutions that say if you call a student by their first name, then that's undue familiarity. You have to call them by their last name all the time. When that is what happens inside of the carceral space anyway, so they are expecting you as the instructor to be a tentacle of the carceral space, even though you are part of the higher ed institution. And so there is certainly something to be said for that. In terms of connection being contraband, but being an educator and being in education means that the relationship that you establish with students is one that you are then able to leverage to engage students to give 100% at all times. And so there's got to be some nuance on the part, I think, of corrections to get a better sense of like what healthy relationships look like in a classroom, and making allowances for those.
Yeah. And just going off of that, human connection is not just the physical touching. And so we as educators, when we go into that space, and especially as Black women, and particularly when our classes are full of predominantly Black and brown bodies, we're able to make that connection without even touching. And there is no way to to label that as contraband. It's because that is on a spiritual level that no one else would be able to do, I'll just say. So I'll leave it at that.
I know we're running out of time, so I'd like to ask you as my final question, what do you both hope this episode sparks for listeners?
I wanted to spark maybe a little bit of outrage. Outrage is always, for me, is a good thing because it can lead to change. I want people to want to learn more about higher education in prison and what it really is. I want people to check out the Jami Sisterhood on Twitter and at our website, jamisisterhood.com. And I just want people to really understand that education is not reserved for the privileged folk in these Ivy League institutions. Education is not reserved for privileged people, privileged meaning people who have the privilege of not being incarcerated. Higher education is not just reserved for people in the alleged free world, but that higher education is a right, and it is one that should not be taken away from people just because they are in prison.
Ditto. That's all I'm gonna say.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Dr. Bria Willingham and Dr. Erin Corbett, telling us about your work in higher education in prison and about the Jami Sisterhood and about the newly launched Journal of Higher Education in Prison. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and you've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.